That's the question of materialism and having enough or more than enough, which is our problem, mostly. Let's try and understand some aspects of this and see what it is that we're supposed to do with the material world, especially here, especially us. And what we'd like to try and show is that relating to the physical world or the material world incorrectly is a lethal problem. That is not just a nice spiritual idea to be able to deny physicality or rise above it. We're not talking about that. What we have to understand is that relating to the physical world incorrectly is relating to the death world, and can cause severe repercussions, certainly at least in this world, and more seriously in the next world. Try and understand this. And let's try also to include enough practical ideas. That means to know what it is exactly that one has to do with one's possessions. Is one allowed to have? Isn't one allowed to have? What do you do with what you have already? Let's try and understand. You see in this week's Sedra, it's worth reading through in great detail. Every Sedra is. But this week you have an insight into events, into a certain personality, certain non-Jewish personality, who was the greatest man who ever lived in the non-Jewish world, and in many ways greater than some of the greatest Jews who ever lived. And you have the story of a man who was able to rationalize and not see correctly because of a problem with his relationship to the material world in such a way that it's a fascinating, one of the most fascinating parshas in the Torah, and a long, long space in Torah is devoted to this particular individual, Bilam, and the way he saw the world and what happened to him. Let's try and understand, let's try just to pick out that particular theme. We'll try and look again, last week we tried to look at the story of Korach and try and pick out particular ideas that we could build into a theme, extract from it. Let's try and understand what happened to Bilam and try and extract from that story this particular theme and what it means to us. I'm not going to go through the details of the story, but very briefly, especially for those who may not be familiar with it in detail, very briefly, this is what happened. While the Jews were traveling through the desert, while they were encamped and traveling through the Sinai desert, there was a man called Bilam who headed the non-Jewish nations. That means he was the spiritual guide or leader with the most powerful prophetic voice who ever certainly lived in that generation. In some ways, the Mefarshim are clear that he was greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. There were certain aspects of his prophetic ability, that means of his knowledge of the higher worlds and his connection to the higher worlds, that were greater than Moses, greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. You'll see the commentaries in some ways compare him to Abraham, to Avraham Avinu. Try and understand why. So Bilam was a man who was on this highest level that's ever been experienced by a human being in certain ways. He headed the non-Jewish nations. It says that anything they needed to know, they used to come to him. He was the final authority, spiritual, practical matters. When the Jews received the Torah, it says that all non-Jewish nations in the world tried to flock towards Sinai. They felt something special was happening. At first they thought it was a distraction. They went to Bilam and they asked him, "What is this cosmic event that's taking place?" They thought it was another flood or a destruction of the world by fire. And Bilam said, "Hashem, o Islam, o Yitain, you don't have to worry. Hashem's giving Torah to the world." And it says that because of that, the nations began to flock towards Sinai. And then Amalek, another nation, managed to dissuade them and attack the Jews, and the nations stepped back. But Bilam was the one who guided them in that at that crucial moment, in that generation. So when the Jews passed near the territory of Moab, the king, Balak, decided to try and wipe them out, wipe out the Jewish nation. It was our problem in that generation, as it has been since. And he tried to hire, engage the services of Bilam. He knew that the Jewish people were spiritual people. There was no way you could destroy them militarily. That had been proved a number of times during the desert experience. He felt that militarily to attack the Jewish people with their incredible spiritual power was a futile exercise, and therefore you meet like with light, with like. The way to do it would be to try and battle them on a spiritual plane and destroy them spiritually. And to do that, he engaged the services, or tried, to hire the services of Bilaam, who was a man so powerful spiritually that it was believed that would he curse the Jewish people, if he would curse them, again, we're not talking about a... I was trying not to translate it into modern terms. It doesn't mean to utter a curse. It means to call down a spiritual judgment upon them, so intense and so accurate that itself would wipe them out. He tried to do that, and that's where the story begins. To understand that Bilaam wasn't going to pronounce some magical or mystical curse that could destroy the Jewish people. Obviously, if they were on that spiritual level that they couldn't be destroyed physically or materially, then obviously a curse is even sillier. Because if they're favored by Hashem in the spiritual world, and that's where their power comes from, so then to pronounce a curse against them, a mere human being, no matter how great, to pronounce a curse against the whole Jewish, the whole people, the greatest people on earth, not going to have any effect on them. But the understanding is something like this, that what he hoped to be able to do is to try and refine our ideas and not remember the stories the way we learned them when we were six. Try to refine our sensitivity, to understand them on a deeper plane. What Bilaam hoped to do and what Balak hoped he would be able to do would be to look at the Jewish people and perceive a spiritual weakness. That means to be able to call into play a spiritual weakness. And that itself would be, and in fact he almost succeeded, although he wasn't able to curse, but it says that later, much later, after the attempt to curse failed, he advised the women of that nation, to entice the Jewish men into an immoral relationship with them. Actually, it was only a prelude to worshipping certain idolatrous practices or gods that they had, and that would bring about the destruction of Jews. It almost did, and it almost did. Many, many Jews were lost because of that. In other words, the policy, the idea, the principle, the battle strategy was not to invoke a curse where a curse didn't exist. The policy was to try and perceive what the Jewish people were, find a spiritual weakness, and at that level of greatness, a small weakness is held very culpable, accountable, and therefore be able to show that up, and therefore be able to bring about their destruction in that way. And that was a hope. It was a realistic, I mean, at least in some sense, a realistic hope. I mean, Bilaam was too great a man and too intelligent a man to set out on a hopeless mission, to set out as a human being with prophetic abilities and curse the Jewish people and wipe them out through that. That's not what he planned to do. But in effect, that was to be the outcome. So what happened was this. Balak knew that Bilaam was a man of tremendous spiritual greatness, but he knew that he had a weakness. And his weakness was his attachment to the material world. He loved physicality. He loved the material. He loved money. Actually, he knew that he loved the material world in a worse way than that. So try to stop and understand. As we go through the story, let's try and stop off and illustrate the points that are relevant to the theme that we're trying to discuss. There are many, many themes in Bilaam. Many, many amazing mystical themes also. But let's try and pick out the elements that what we have time for. So Modesta says that you can love money in two different ways. You can have an attachment to the material world in two different ways. One is much worse than the other. There are two reasons a person can love materialism. One is called taiva and one is called gaiva. Now, two forces that operate in the human psyche, say, in the neshama. One is called taiva. Taiva means lust. That means physical desire for its own sake. Desire for pleasure, involvement in the physical for its own sake. The other is called gaiva. Gaiva means the opposite pole of the spectrum in a certain way, in a certain sense. It's the desire for elevation in its neutral sense. In its bad sense, it's called pride. Positive sense, it's a tremendous spiritual drive to reach one's potential, to reach one's greatness, which is paradoxically an annulment of the ego and a fulfillment of the ego, as we've tried to discuss, tried last week to show. But those are the two drives. A person can love the physical world because of either of those drives. Again, a person can love materialism because he loves material, that means he enjoys physicality, or a person can love the material world because it feeds his sense of power. There are two reasons a person can want money. Either he can want money because he wants what money can buy. That means he wants the power of the money to buy the goods that he wants to buy. Or a person can want money because he wants money, because he wants power. What's the difference? What's the difference? The male personality, by the way. The male personality tends to want the power for the sake of power. The spectrum of being male, Moses say that actually it changes with age. It changes with age. A young man, young men usually want power for the sake of the power plus the material benefit that it can bring. On the contrary, young men usually want the power, the covet, that means the honor or the spiritual power, in order to achieve a physical end, ends of pleasure. So they usually focus it in that direction. Older men usually gradually transition into a phase where they want the financial or the material power in order to achieve honor. Very interesting. Once there was a meeting of certain Rabbonim during the days of Rabbi Leib Chassman, and one old rabbi got up and he said, I'm able to be objective about this particular issue that they were discussing because I'm so old that I don't feel the damage, I don't feel the effect of covet anymore, of glory seeking, of covet, of honor. So Chassman got up immediately and he said, that's not correct. The older you get, the worse it gets. The older you get, the more a person has a need to be respected. A young person usually is able to sublimate more of his power into physical pleasure, and an older person, especially men, usually tend to translate their power into the sense of recognition or honor. They need that. Now, the difference between these two is as follows. And which is worse? Which is worse? Well, there's no question that which is worse is where the desire for the material comes from a source that's spiritual. Much worse than if it comes from a desire just to be physical. Understand why? Although the one is a loneliness, that means if a person wants physical pleasure just for the sake of physical pleasure, that's a loneliness. But it's much less dangerous than if he wants physical pleasure, or if he wants physical potential, power, in order to have the power. Even though that comes from a spiritual root. Let's try and illustrate it. There are two kinds. Let's take a crude example. Let's say somebody who actually loves for once money. So there are two ways the person can want the money. Either he can want it because he wants to buy a certain thing, right, or certain things. Or he can want it because he just wants the power. He wants the power, wants to have the money. Wants to have it. The difference is this. The person has to think very carefully about this and see where one fits into this picture. What exactly is my particular problem? If a person wants money in order to achieve certain ends, so that is self-limiting. This is what Mephoshim is saying. When you have enough money for that thing, you won't want the money anymore. You'll buy the thing and you'll be happy, at least for a while. But you'll want enough only to achieve what it is that you want to do. It means it's only a means to an end. And therefore, you'll spend it to achieve that end, and that'll limit the desire. Right? First of all. Second of all, it's self-limiting in another way. Physical pleasure, for its own sake, is self-limiting because there's only so much of it you can have before it becomes disgusting. I'll try and explain that in a moment. But when a person wants power for the sake of power, then by definition, it's unlimited. When a person wants money just because he wants to be rich, so then it says nobody ever has enough, and it says nobody dies with half of his desire achieved. Nobody. That means a person who wants to be wealthy for the sake of being wealthy never is happy with what he has. The government says quite clearly, one who has 100 wants 200. One who has 200 wants 400. And nobody who's on that mode, that line of development, no one ever dies with half yet of what he wants. No matter how powerful he is, he then starts comparing himself to somebody else who's more powerful or wealthier, and therefore he wants that much, and he's never happy with what he has. Now, there's an amazing mystical understanding to this, which we must go into, and that's as follows. Why is it that the desire for physical pleasure is limited? That means if you want the power to buy something physical, or you want the physicality or the pleasure of the physical, why is it that that's limited? But if you want the power to achieve power, not just to be able to buy, although you don't actually want to buy, you just want to be able to have the power, and what that power, the power that it can, that you wield is an end in itself, why is that unlimited? Why should it be that way? Why is it that a person doesn't want more and more and more of a physical thing, but he does want more and more and more of a spiritual thing, of this honor, which is on the spiritual plane, of this power, honor, whatever, kind of. So the answer is clear if you think about it. You don't need this to be proved. You just have to stop and be sensitive for a moment. Because the physical world is a limited world. The physical world, by definition, is a finite, limited world. So the involvement in it always, since we reverberate, we resonate with the thing that we're in love with, so you resonate in tune with the physical world. And since it's a limited world, it conveys its limitation to you. But the spiritual world, when you want power, power is a spiritual concept. It's not a physical object. It's an ability, it's a mode in the neshama. And since it's generated by the spiritual world, and the spiritual world by definition is the unlimited world, so the desire that's on that plane is unlimited. And you never can have enough. And you can check it out. You can see it. You don't need to take it from me. The Gemara says that a person who eats honey becomes disgusted with honey. You know, if you try it, you take a small bottle of honey. I invite you to do this simple experiment when you get home. take a small bottle of honey and a medium-sized teaspoon and start eating big teaspoons of the honey. What will happen is that the first mouthful, if you're sensitive to what honey is a very, very, it's a powerful experience. You're sensitive to it. It's a powerful experience. But the point of disgust comes much sooner than you'd ever believe. Probably by the second teaspoon. Probably. Probably. Nobody gets through half a bottle of honey. And the thing is that not only does it not become a desire anymore, but it becomes disgusting. It's a unique feature of the physical world. It's a unique feature. Not just that you don't want anymore, but what happens is when you pass that point of having had too much, what happens is the experience becomes disgusting and you couldn't bear to take more of that pleasure. This happens also, people who translate their, again, it's too intimate an area to go into here in detail, but people who translate their relationship, marriage, and focus on the physical elements, unfortunately, not just that the marriage doesn't have what it should have, but there's an element of disgust. Women find that hard to understand, but men find it easy to understand. And that's what it is. But when a person puts himself into, and of course, as always, and we'll see it from the story of Bilam also, when you get involved in the desire for physicality, it makes a fool of you. It makes a fool of you. For example, we'll see it with Bilam, his donkey started speaking to him. His donkey spoke to him. Hashem tried to warn him what he was doing by creating the ability, specially creating the ability of his donkey to speak to him and tell him what he was doing wrong. And he didn't even notice that the donkey was speaking. But he started speaking to it as if it was completely normal for his donkey to speak. And he was made a fool of. The Gemara says that when the donkey started speaking to him and giving him trouble and saying, why are you doing this, and upbraiding him, so Bilam said, if I had a sword, I'd kill you. So Mephoshim say, what a pathetic fool he made of himself. He's on his way to curse a nation with his word. He's about to destroy the whole Jewish people with a word. But a miserable donkey, he can't cope with unless he has a sword. He didn't realize, and he didn't even realize the irony of what he was saying. It makes a fool of you. When you're engaged in physical pleasure, the way it goes is this. You have some of it and you feel you want more. So then you have some more and you feel you want more. And then you think, you know there'll be a point of disgust, you know there'll be a point of satiety when you've had enough, but it always fools you into taking more, and when you suddenly realize, when you realize that, you realize that you've long passed the point of where it became disgusting. Long ago. But it makes a fool of you. It draws you in, and it draws you in, and you become irrational, and you don't think clearly until you realize you long ago overdid it. That's the pathway. Makes a fool of a person. The person gets involved in the physical, and his mind becomes a servant of the physical, starts to rationalize, doesn't think straight anymore, and he hears things exactly the way he shouldn't hear them. Let's continue in the story of Bilam and see how that works. And we'll try and understand how the South African Jewish community has allowed itself to tune into this wavelength, unfortunately, in many ways. I'm not saying that it outweighs the beauty of this community and its intense connection to Jewish values that remain, but this is a danger zone that we have to watch very carefully. So let's understand. Balak sends Bilam the following message. He sends him honored messengers, honored emissaries, viceroys of his realm. He sends them to Bilam and he says, Balak is ready to pay you whatever you want. Interesting. He doesn't even think that Bilam will be offended by being bought. He knows Bilam so well. Yeah? That means this man, greatest spiritual man on earth, and in many ways is, but people can get a feel. That means there's no way you can hide that. You hear what the story is teaching you. Balak wasn't even concerned in the least that this great spiritual man, everybody knows that spirituality means conquering the physical, it's the only way you get there. But he felt so intensely this inner drive of Bilam's to get involved in physicality, and for the worst reason, as we said before, the drive for honor, the drive for power in itself. That means to feed the ego, which has no limitation. Don't get disgusted of that. On the contrary, the more you have, the more you want. He feels it so intensely that he sends him a message and he says, I'll pay you whatever you want. In other words, I'm going to buy you. I'm going to employ you. I'll pay you whatever you want to come and curse the Jewish people. I've got masses. I've had a fortune, the king, quite one of the greatest kings on earth. You come and curse the Jewish people for me, and I'll pay you whatever you name your price. So the messengers come, you hear what he's doing. He feeds his drive for materialism, and he feeds his drive for honor. He sends him very, very honored notables, and he sends them with an offer of great fortune. So they approach Bilam, and they say, Balak has sent us, and he offers you an untold fortune if you'll come and curse the Jewish people. So Bilam immediately says to them the following thing.
Im yiten li Balak, meloi beisa. If Balak gives me his house full, that means his whole realm full of silver and gold. Right? And in that he names the details. Silver and gold. Gives me everything he has. How can I ever think of speaking against what Hashem wants? In other words, basically no. But he says it. He doesn't say no. He says, he first turns over the promise of the physicality in his mind. And the Chazal say here a fascinating thing. They say that contrary to popular belief, it's a wonderful lesson in real psychology. How people really work, this part. Chazal say that the world tends to think that what a person says shows you who he is. You listen carefully to what a person says, you'll see who he is. Torah says exactly the opposite. It's who a person is that makes you understand what he says. You have to know first who the person is, and then you can understand what he does or says. The world thinks opposite. The world looks superficially. Don't look at the man or the woman. Just let's hear what he says, what comes from the lips and out. And then you'll be able to make a judgment about the person. That's why the world judges people. They listen to what people say. They accept the promises and the false inanities that people in power put forth. And they judge them on those grounds. But Torah looks exactly the opposite at a person. First you have to be a somebody, then we'll listen to what you say. Yeshua ben Kisma, one of the great Tanoim, he met a man on the road once. The man said to him, Rebbe, come to live where I live and I'll give you a fortune. So he said to him the following words, if you will give me all the silver and gold and diamonds and jewels in the world, exactly the same phrasing as Bilam used, I wouldn't go and live in a place where there's no Torah. I wouldn't do that. So the Mephoshim say, you see, here two men speaking the same, but the one meant it and the one didn't mean it. The words don't show you. He really meant it. And no matter what you gave him, he wouldn't have gone to live in a place where there was no Torah, and he didn't go. But Bilam was only just trying to feel out the field in such a way that he could extract more, that's all. But you can't tell from the words. You have to know who the person is. It's a very sharp example of it. When Yaakov was going to marry, remember how hard he worked for the women, for Rachel and Leah. So when the day came for the wedding, he says to Laban a very amazing thing. He says to him, give me my wife that I may go in unto her. I mean, watch him say a very crude, I mean, Rashi points out, he says that the lowliest of people don't speak that way. I mean, he said it very, Rashi says, what did he want? To bring forth the Jewish people. He wanted to father the tribes, the sons, that would be the Jewish people. But Rashi says, but the lowliest of people don't speak that way. He says, explains Rashi, that depends who you are. Depends who you are. If you say it at a level, if you're at a level of purity and you say it at a level of purity, it's a thing of purity. Not to be ashamed of. Not to be ashamed of. That's who he was and that's what he meant. And what a dream, it occurred to him to have it in any other way that wasn't refined. So he meant it refined. The trouble is we don't hear it like that because we're not refined. So we hear things, as we've been taught to hear things, which is on the lower level. But you first have to know who the person is. So knowing who Bilam is, and Balak knew very well who Bilam was, he sends in these messengers and that's what he does. So Bilam says like this. He says, no matter what you give me, I couldn't go. But let me ask Hashem. First mistake. You know, in other words, I mean, can you imagine a man at his level? He knows Hashem. He knows Hashem and his love for his people so acutely, so intimately, that it says that in some ways he knew Hashem's ways in the world more intensely than Moshe Rabbeinu, than Moses. You know, it says, Leikam b'Yisrael k'Moshe od Novi. There never arose in the Jewish people a prophet like Moses. So the Mephoshim make the most incredible deduction from that statement. Listen carefully to the words. There never arose in the Jewish nation a prophet like Moshe. You know what the Mephoshim say? Not in the Jewish nation, but yes, in the non-Jewish nations. That's what they learn from that statement. That means there was a non-Jew who reached that level. So they say clearly that Bilam reached that level, and there are ways, there are certain angles, certain aspects where he reached a higher level than Moshe. So this man on this level who knows so much about Hashem is considering here going to curse Hashem's people and wipe them out. Why is he beginning to think irrationally? We're talking, you have to understand very clearly, we're not talking about somebody who hadn't worked on himself. We're not talking about a lowly individual who's brought up in a way that made him. We're talking about the greatest man on earth in many ways. Probably the greatest man who ever lived. In some ways as great as Avram Avinu. Some of the same words are used by him as used by Aaron. It says, got up early in the morning, it says he harnessed his donkey. He's saying things exactly, and the Mephoshim here, parallel. Between the greatness of Avram Avinu, the man who brought the world to its feet. Put the world here. The man for whom the world was created, his marriage was so great. In this man, they see a parallel of that. And he's beginning to think in a crazily irrational way. That's the first thing you learn, is that when you have a drive or a desire for the lower self, then the higher self becomes a servant to it, and you don't think straight anymore. You don't think as straight as a much, much more lowly individual would think. But even a child could see through it, and you don't see through it. So he waits to hear a message from Hashem, and Hashem says, no, don't go. Hashem says, don't go with him. Of course Hashem tells him, don't go with him. He goes to sleep, he has a dream, a prophetic dream, and Hashem says, do not go with these people. What does he hear? He says to himself, like, as Hashem says, don't go with these people. Now, what does that mean? Now, let's think about it. What does that mean? You know what the Mephoshim say? He rationalized to himself the following thing. Hashem told me not to go with these people. You know what he must mean? Not with these people. Not with these. But that's why, please, since, of course, if he sends people more on it, you know, more important kind of emissaries, then maybe Hashem wants me to consider it. But you hear what's going on here? They say, you see it over and over in Torah. Paroi, for example, Pharaoh, when the plagues were smiting Egypt, and the place was being wiped out, Egypt wasn't heard again from after that. The country was being decimated systematically. Paroi kept maintaining that he was right to keep the Jewish people enslaved. Ideologically and idealistically, he kept saying he was right. And when his advisors came to him and said, but look, you just saw a plague. You saw a plague wipe out your country. What do you say? What do you mean Hashem's on your side and you're doing right? So he turned to them and he said, yes, it stopped, didn't it? It stopped. That means you see Hashem's agreeing with me. He stopped the plague. Must mean he agrees with me. Yeah, the way people think. And of course it took Paroi to ride into the sea to a certain death. I mean, he rode into the walls of water about to come crashing down on him after witnessing completely transcendent phenomena. Bilam does the same. So then what happens is, he's not satisfied with those emissaries. But when the situation is right and the scene is set correctly and the promises of money are big enough and the emissaries are right, then he asks again, imagine the chutzpah, to come back to Hashem and say, well, Hashem, what about now? And Hashem says to him an amazing thing. He says, yes, go. You learn from this a much more telling lesson than we learned up to now. And that is, in a way that a person wants to go, they lead you in that way. That means Hashem himself, that means from the spiritual world. That means you control the spiritual world. If you want to go in a certain direction, and you make a sincere effort in that direction, it can be the worst direction in the world, but they'll help you. They'll give you proofs, they'll help you. If Hashem could speak to you personally, he would tell you, yes, go and do this wrong thing. Because you want to go in that direction, so the world shapes itself according to your desire. That means you can't. A person must never think that because they see things are going well in this direction, and even amazing things are happening in this direction, well, it's a proof that Hashem wants this. On the contrary, not at all. So Hashem says to Bilam, yes, go with him. Sure, go. But remember that you'll only be able to say what I tell you. You're a prophet. You're going to speak with Nebuah, with prophecy. You'll only say what I put into your mouth. And Bilam says, of course, don't think otherwise. And he tells the emissaries, I'll go with you. Hashem has said that I can go with you. But you should know I'll only be able to say what Hashem says. Be very firm talk. I'm on the level where Hashem speaks to me. Whatever he says, I say. Don't think you can buy me. Don't think you can buy me. So he says he'll go. So what happens? He gets on his donkey. Just like Avram Avinu also, when Hashem sent him someplace, except where he sent him was to sacrifice his son. So it says he got up early in the morning, didn't delay, to find a rationalization. It's a person who's guided by his higher self. And he's not trying to find what his vested interests, his emotions or his physicality want. So he functions exactly the same way in the opposite direction. He got up early in the morning, he could have delayed. Shem didn't say rush. He said, rush, kill your son. A few more hours. Got up early in the morning, saddled his donkey, rode on it, rode off to Har Moriah to sacrifice his son. Bilam got on his donkey, and he rode off towards Bilam towards Balak to curse the Jewish people. On the way, the donkey starts speaking to him. The donkey speaks. And the donkey says to him, what happens is that an angel appears in the road. And Bilam, one of the wonderful things in the story, we don't have time, it says, but Silochet's regal Bilam Elakir, his leg was squashed against the wall. What wall? What wall? So, we don't have time for this in detail, but before Shim said that it was the wall of a Matseva, a monument that had been a pile of stones that had been erected as a sign of a treaty between Yaakov and Laban many generations before. That had been a treaty that they would never cross over, that Laban would never cross over this Gal Ed, this particular monument, to harm the Jewish people. And the Mephoshim, the Kabbalistic commentaries say that Bilam was Laban, a reincarnation of the same force, was breaking the covenant now and trying to go past that piece of evidence, right, be that as it may. But as he moves through that point, an angel appears to the donkey. Not to Bilam. Angel appears to the donkey. And the angel won't let the donkey go. So the donkey crouches down and it squashes Bilam's leg, and at one gun he starts beating the donkey. What Hashem's trying to tell him is that what even the donkey can see, he can't see. So finally the donkey starts speaking to him. But before she goes into detail, they say that Chaim Shmulevitz points out that Hashem will do almost anything to save a man's honor, even a person who is so lowly and so bent on destruction, but Hashem won't shame him more than necessary. And he'll even create a special creation to try and save him, and he'll try and put it to him in incontrovertible terms. But a person who's bent on that course of action, he'll turn everything into the way he sees things. So the donkey starts speaking to him and says, "Why are you hitting me? Haven't I been your faithful donkey for such a long time? Did I ever not listen to you?" And Bilam doesn't even notice that the donkey is speaking to him. He says, "No, you're right, you've never done this, but why?" You know, the whole conversation with the donkey. And finally, he sees the angel. Which means he now realizes that his eyes were so closed. That's what he says. He calls himself Neufel, Uglui Einayim, a man who has fallen and had his eyes opened. That's how he describes himself. Now his eyes are opened and he sees the donkey. And he's warned again that he won't be able to do except what Hashem commands him. Before Hashem said the donkey died right after that. It's very interesting. Chaim says that the donkey died because a number of reasons throughout on a mystical plane, but one of the reasons that in the Bala Musa bring is that the donkey died because it would have been a great disgrace to Bilam. It's an incredible thing to think of. To have a donkey walking around that people could point to and say, "This is the donkey that spoke, that Hashem sent to embarrass Bilam." He didn't deserve that kind of embarrassment. That means, bad as he was, and with the end that he suffered, killed by the Jewish people. But he still didn't deserve that, and so Hashem put to death the donkey. An incredible lesson you learn from what it means to shame someone, and that a person should never be shamed more than what they deserve, even when they're in the worst situation. He travels on with his donkey. Before Hashem said a very interesting thing, difficult again to discuss in detail, but if you note very carefully the psukim, you'll see there an incredible thing. It says there are many parallels, as I pointed out, with the greatest man on earth, greatest man who ever lived, Abraham. But especially it says parallels with the donkey. The whole business of the donkey. The Chumash doesn't waste its time telling you, it doesn't matter how you travelled there, it's irrelevant to us, he got there. The whole business, that he, and for that matter, Avraham Avinu, that he sat on his donkey, are we concerned how he got to Har Moriah? He travelled for 3 days with his son Yitzhak to sacrifice him as an offering on the Mizbah. He had to travel on a donkey, are we concerned how he got there? Why does it say the Mashiach would arrive on a white donkey? We don't mind if he arrives by some airline or other. Don't bother us. What's our concern? What's the Mufashim Midrashim say that the Mashiach would arrive on a donkey? And why a donkey? And why the same donkey that Avraham Avinu rode? That's what it says. The Mashiach, that donkey's still around. Nebuch, that donkey is still around. That the Mashiach's going to arrive on the donkey that Avraham Avinu rode to the Akedah, the Mashiach's going to arrive on that donkey. What does it mean? Why a white donkey? What's going on? In other words, what's going on? So to us, we haven't been taught anything in Torah. To us, it's a mystery. But anybody who understands anything in Torah, understands Hebrew even, knows that the word donkey, chamor, is the word chomer, materialism. This is not something that's been made up. It's the same word. It's not something you have to have a poetic ear for. That's the same word. In Chumash, we don't have vowels. It's exactly the same word. The Poshim say it means this. You have to hear this very carefully. Poshim say it means this. When the Chumash tells you that Avraham Avinu got up in the morning and he saddled his donkey, Kivesh, to saddle it means, actually the word actually means like to conquer it. He controlled it and he got on it and he rode it. And he rode towards the Akedah. And he went with his two lads, it says, Yishmael and Eliezer. He rode towards the Akedah. And it says, when he reached the bottom of the mountain, it says, "You wait here. You wait here with the donkey. Shulachem poem achamor. You wait with the donkey." Chumash has to tell you, imagine a small talk. Avraham Avinu climbs off his donkey. He takes his son Yitzchak. And he walks towards the Akedah where he's about to sacrifice his son. And he turns to the two boys that he's leaving behind, his other son Yishmael and Eliezer. And he says to them, "You stay here with the donkey." Chumash has to repeat that. That's significant. I need to know what he said to them about looking after the donkey. Poshim say, that's not what's going on. What's going on is this. The donkey represents materialism. Chamor in Hebrew. By the way, the mystics go into the fact that every animal actually represents a certain force, a certain type of personality, a certain force in the world. The donkey always represents pure materialism. There's certain reasons why a donkey does. But before even going into it, we won't go into that this evening, just the word itself, chamor, means chomer, means materialism. It means the material world. Chomer means chomriyut. Chomriyut means the material, the gashmias, that's what it means, physicality. When it says Avraham Avinu rode his donkey, it means he sat on top of the material world. The material world was a vehicle for him. He didn't go side by side with his donkey. He wasn't controlled by his donkey. He was a man who rode on top of it, and that's exactly what the Mashiach will be, of course. And that's why, of course, it will be the same donkey. It means that the world of the material, the pull of the material, and what the material can do, and the power of materialism in the physical world, he rode on top of it. And the two lads, they say, it's another story, not for now, but basically, there are three levels to a person. There's the seichel, the higher faculty of the neshama, there's the emotional level, which is considered to be the middle level, and then there's the physical drives, which is considered the lower level. He said to the two of them, there were three boys, understand what's going on, three aspects to his being in the world. One of them was at the higher level, able to become a sacrifice to Hashem. Pure neshama. The next was the material, the emotional, the next was the material. So of course that's what he said. He said, you stay here with the donkey, it's beautiful. I'm going up. Going up a mountain also doesn't mean climbing a mountain. We don't care where the arcade took place. It could have been in a valley, on a plain, on a mountain, it doesn't matter. But the point is, up on a mountain means in a position of spiritual elevation. So as he's about to elevate himself into a spiritual world, he says to the lower elements of his being, that you stay here with the material. It's a fantastic idea. And they stay with the donkey. Now if you think about that carefully, when you look through the story of Bilam, you'll see a very, very striking thing. The donkey of Bilam is not called a chamor. It's called an aton. The difference is that it's the female of a donkey. Chamor is the male and aton is a female. Bilam had a female donkey, and the Mefarshim say that he was married to his donkey. He lived with his donkey. He was married to his donkey, literally. Hard for us to go into detail. That's what he did. Right. What does it mean again? What does it mean? First of all, it means it's simple, straightforward. It means exactly what it says. Now, he's a man of guilt. He was guilty of being able. He was on such a level of bestiality. He was so intensely involved with the world in that way that he couldn't even control himself at that level. But of course, on a deeper level, what it means is that he couldn't rise above. It's hard for us to go into detail. You'd have to work it out for yourself. But he was unable to control that area. He didn't ride his donkey like Avraham Avinu did, that the donkey was a male thing called a mashpia, that he was able to ride and use as a vehicle. Bilam couldn't do that. And so instead of riding it, he married it. And that's why his donkey spoke to him. Haven't I served you faithfully? Look at those words carefully and see. Haven't I always served you faithfully? Never disobeyed you? Look carefully with more. We have to be a little bit gluey and naim ourselves, a little bit of opened eyes ourselves. After that, Bilam gets to the Jewish people, and what happens? He's been made a thorough fool of by now. His donkey has seen things that he hasn't seen. This donkey that he loves. He arrives at the Jewish people, and the rest of the story I'm sure you know, we're not going to go into the details. He tries to curse the Jewish people. He cannot curse them. He opens his mouth to bring out a curse. He tells Balak to build him an altar. I mean, you have to understand what's going on. He says to Balak, in order for me to become inspired prophetically and curse these people, take me to a vantage point where I can overlook the Jewish people. Let me overlook their tents where they're encamped in the desert. Build me an altar to Hashem. Let us sacrifice sacrifices to Hashem. He wasn't trying to do this against Hashem. He wanted Hashem with him. It's the only way he could operate. Let's offer sacrifices to Hashem. And when I'm elevated to that spiritual peak, I'll then be able to curse the Jewish people. And he does. He does. Balak builds him an altar, and he gets high, and he looks out at the Jewish people, and as he tries to say a curse, the most incredible brachas, blessings, expressions of the greatness of the Jewish people come out. And it's a long portion. It happens three times. And he tries again. He tries to look from another position. And he tries to look from another position. And each time he tries to say a curse, the most fantastic brachas that have ever been said about the Jewish people come out. The depths of Torah. Some people say those every day. No one has ever said more eloquent praise of the Jewish people and more beautiful poetry about the greatness and the depth and the sensitivity and the spirituality of the Jewish people than Bilam, who together with his donkey came to curse the Jewish people. Now, which of course means, again, you have to understand this is not tonight's subject of the materialism, but what a person has to understand is that what's going to come out of you is going to come out of you. The Kavod Shemayim that has to come out of you, no matter what way you try and duck and dodge, they're going to get it out of you. If they have to make a fool out of you to get it out of you, they're going to get it out of you. And if you have to die and scream in the next world to get it out of you, it's going to be got out of you. Nobody's here to escape what he's been put here to do. That's unfortunately the message. Unfortunately, that is the message. You can duck and dodge and do it for this reason and that reason and try your best and so on, but in the end, the Kiddush Hashem, the Kavod Shemayim, the glory of Hashem's name that has to come out in the world because of you is going to come out, and it's going to come out because of you. Either through your being disintegrated, or through your screams, or through your doing it willingly, but it's going to come out of you, out of us. That you see clearly. The point is that he tries to curse. And he tries and tries and tries, and you read the words there, the most beautiful words, Ma toivu o alecha Yaakov, Mishkan osecha Yisrael, how goodly are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. And that some shuls have that written over the door. Some people say it every morning when they wake up. The most beautiful poem about the greatness of the Jewish people. Why did he say those words? He said those words because he saw the Jewish people. And Hashem, you have to understand that a prophet connects with reality. He's not a tape recorder or a microphone. He's connected with reality. And Mefarshim say that every word he said was an incredibly accurate perception of the Jewish people. For example, they're not our subject, so we won't spend much time, but very briefly, for example, why did he praise the Jewish tents? My Toivu or Alecha Yaakov Mishkanos. First of all, the tents and the Mishkanos that he was praising, they're two opinions. They're both true, of course. One is the Jewish homes, the tents that are our homes, and the other is the dwelling places of Torah. The tents that are the dwelling places of the Beis Medrash, the Shul. the Beis Medrash, the place that people sit and learn Torah, the beauty of that, what he could see, that, what that was, what a dwelling place for the Shekhinah that was in the Jewish people he praised. But even at the simple level, the Mefarshim say, why did he praise the tents in which we lived? What did he see? He looked down over the Jewish people from this high plateau, and he saw the tents in the desert. What did he see about the tents? Mefarshim say an incredible thing. He suddenly noticed, he looked at the tents, and he looked from here, and he looked from there, and he suddenly noticed he couldn't see one tent that was pitched in such a way that you could see into the opening of that tent from any other. Isn't that amazing? That the Jews had pitched their tents in such a way that despite being living millions of people in close proximity, 3 million people, in close proximity in a desert camp, there was not a single tent that was pitched in such a way that from any other you could see into this one. That was complete privacy, and you may be sure they were very modest, within the privacy of their own tents. But nobody could even look for a moment into somebody else's tent. You realize they're very spiritual people. Halavai, we should have any of that today. But that's what he saw. And he couldn't bring himself. What could he say negative when he saw that quality? All he could say with him, he was looking for a fault. He was trying to find a chink. He wanted to see one tent that wasn't. One Jew wasn't on the level. And he could use that as an accusation, that Hashem would have to admit, as it were, that that's a negative thing, and then it would call down a curse. By the way, that's what an Ayin Hara is. Ayin Hara. It's not that you look at somebody, you have special x-ray power, or some kind of rays that damage. That's not what it is. Ayin Hara simply means, and it says, Bilam had three qualities. Ayin Hara, he had a bad eye, a wide spirit, that means a covetous nature. Yep. That's what it says, three bad things that he had. But one was Ayin Hara, a bad, evil eye. Evil eye doesn't mean you... What an evil eye means is that you simply perceive a reality, that's all. An evil eye doesn't mean you look at your neighbor and wish him harm, or you send out rays that damage what he has. His family, chas v'shalom, or his possessions, that's not what it is. An evil eye simply means you perceive something that's real. This is the danger, we're speaking about this because this is our subject. Flaunting what you have materially, showing it off what you have materially, is very, very dangerous. Because if someone looks at it and says, but one minute, Hashem, why does he have that thing? Why have you granted him that and that and that and other? Don't I deserve maybe? Are you sure he deserves it? And if the person doesn't thoroughly deserve it, then the books get opened. Because a human being's attitude, he's the way he looks at something, the way he thinks about something, very, very powerful. And therefore, when you make an accusation like that, the books, the ledgers are open in Shemaim, and they start looking if he does or doesn't deserve what he has. And if he doesn't deserve it, they might take it away. Whereas if you don't raise that issue, he might get credit. That's why we don't flaunt what we have in any way. Let's speak about this more. But that's what he said. And one thing after another. In the end it says, unfortunately, the end of the story is not so happy. It says that V'kulan chazru l'klola, all the blessings of Bilam returned to curses, except one, actually, it says in the end. All the things that he cursed the Jewish people with, although Hashem turned them into brachas, but because his intention was negative, in the end they all turned into curses, except one. Ma tovu alecha Yaakov, mishkan asecha Yisrael. The only thing that retained its kedusha of what he said was the goodliness of the Jewish home and the Jewish place where people come and learn the Beis Medrash. And that's why today it says that a Beis Medrash has a din of the Beis HaMikdash. If you step into a place like this place, this room, you're sitting inside the Beis HaMikdash. You're sitting inside the temple. It doesn't mean that if you grow potatoes here, you have to give trumas and maasos from the fruit that you grow. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't have a din of Israel like that. What it means is it has the kedusha of the level of Eretz Yisrael. If you want to feel a little bit what it feels like to live in Yerushalayim, you enter a Beis Medrash and people learn, and you have some of that experience. Have some of the difficulties of that experience and some of the greatness of that experience. That's what it says. And then in the end he was unable to prevail, and he advised them to send their girls in, what curses and spirituality couldn't do, because there was no chink of immorality. He advised them to send in the most beautiful women. And how did the Jews get enticed by these women? A whole story of materialism, what can I tell you? It says that these girls set up booths by the side of the road, offering bargains. That's what it says. The Jews were traveling through the desert, they wouldn't have looked at a woman. But a bargain? What's wrong with a bargain? What's wrong with a bargain? They set up stalls offering goods. So the people went to see, that's all. And after they saw the goods, they saw the women. And after they saw the women said, sure, just all you have to do is this and this and this. A certain procedure that they had to do, which was a worship of a certain thing. And a lot of people died. A lot of people died. Bilam himself tried to escape, it says, by levitating. Levitated is flying, whatever that means. They had to bring him down. Killed him. Got killed in there. Now, what we have to try and understand from this a little bit is the attitude, the Jewish attitude towards this drive for materialism, and how these messages, what we try to hear here in the Sedra, is this, that being materially comfortable, having a lot of possessions, is a very, very dangerous thing. Experience the infinite merge with the finite, whatever that means. Actually, the mystics say it's no greater a miracle than the fact that the Rishis know is this, that being materially comfortable, having a lot of possessions, is a very, very dangerous thing. You can save the situation and avert the danger by using them correctly. Let's try and study this situation. You have two options, basically. Right? I'm sorry if you regret having come this evening. And I hope you'll come again. But the idea is this, that you have two options only. One is to have no possessions, get rid of them. Or the other is to use them correctly. Try and understand this. What's the problem with having a lot of physicality? Of course, you also have to make sure that you have enough to satisfy. You have to be satisfied with what you have. That's what's called rich. It says, Ezu Ashir, who's considered rich? Hasamech Bechelko, somebody who's happy with what he has. Doesn't matter if you have a lot or a little. A very wealthy man who has a lot and craves more is a poor man. He feels the lack of double what he has. That's all he's concerned about, is the lack of what he has. And you'll find the trauma and the family stress and strife and suicide rate and all the other traumas that go with this kind of situation, you'll find them in very, very, very wealthy homes. And you'll find the rationalization that takes place. I'm proud to say that I once had an effect in such a situation. I spoke to a woman of greatness, I can say that in public. She's not here tonight, lives in this town, who once told me that they can't afford to have another child. Because they won't be able to afford to give the child. I pointed out to her, if you would see the home, you would begin to understand. You could have 15 in that home, all comfortably homed in their own bedrooms, with everything that they wanted. It just depends what it is that you think is normal, what has to be given. And I'm happy to say that she had another child, beautiful child on her, that I think is mine. Anyway, that's family. That's the way a person should think. Depends what you think is essential to give. As some great people have said, very often families try to give children a lot. They try and give them everything they can, but except brothers and sisters. When a person shouldn't put off giving children brothers and sisters because they want to give them, you know, brother or sister that has four wheels or some other expensive toys. So, like this, why is it dangerous to have these things? Why should we be concerned about it? So the first idea, we don't have time to go into all the angles, but one idea that a person has to know is this, that the Chofetz Chaim used to put it this way. The Chofetz Chaim's policy was to have very little. Very little. The Chofetz Chaim didn't even have in his home a full set of Shas. A set of Gemaras. Because he said that to own Gemaras, of course he knew it by heart, he didn't need a Shas like we do. But he said that to own the books he would have to spend the time earning the money. And to earn the money, it would take time. Time from learning, time from Torah. Didn't want to do that. The Chofetz Chaim, I once met his grandson, who told us that the Chofetz Chaim didn't have backs to his chairs. He had two benches next to the table. That's how he lived. The only thing that he ever had of any value was well-known was silver candlesticks. Well-known story, and we know it because when they were stolen once, the Chofetz Chaim discovered the person stealing them and he ran down the road after him saying, you can have them, they're a gift, they're yours. He didn't want the person to go over the Avera of Gezel, didn't want him to be liable for theft. So he ran down the road after him, giving them as a gift, so this Jew wouldn't transgress. Right? The Chofetz Chaim said that he lived frugally because he was worried that if he lived expensively, he might have to account for it. There's a famous story about his attitude to this, is that all the greats were like this, but even those who were wealthy related to it in this way. But many were poverty stricken and chose to be that way. Many stories. You can read, you should read. Chaim Sonnenfeld, the Guardian of Jerusalem, you should read that book. And other books are around that period. Once a man from Vienna came to see the Chofetz Chaim. He heard about this great sage, the leader of the generation, a wealthy Jew on business, came into the home of the Chofetz Chaim and he was shocked, none, to see that the Chofetz Chaim lived in a situation where there weren't even backs to the chairs, there was nothing in the house. So he said to him, Rebbe, a great man such as you, where's all your... You live so poorly. So the Chofetz Chaim said to him, I don't see your possessions. Where are your possessions? So he said, but Rebbe, I'm traveling. I don't have anything here, but you should see where I'm going. The Chofetz Chaim said, where I'm going, I have plenty too. He used to say that if you live expensively, the way you live here is an expense account. That's all. What you extract from the world here is your expense account. You're supposed to be sending home the goods. When a traveler sent out by his company. So that company doesn't mind if he stays at the most expensive hotel and lives on caviar, whatever it is that they live on at those places. They don't mind if he sends home a few deals that pay for the expenses and turn a profit. But if he lives in the most expensive hotels and doesn't make any deals, doesn't sell anything, what, they're going to call him home? No company's going to afford an expense. So it says, Hashem has sent you here to do a job. He wants you to bring home the goods. The goods are what you're supposed to be coming over here. What you're supposed to be making of yourself and your family and those you know. How you're supposed to be changing the world. So if you deliver the goods, they don't mind if you run a rich expense account. But if you're not sending home the goods, you better be very sure that you're sending home the goods. You better be very sure. We have to be very, very sure that we are delivering the goods, that we're working on what we're supposed to be working on, that when we call to account at the end, it'll turn out that we generated more income than the expense account they spent on us. The Chofetz Chaim himself used to tell a story. I'll just tell you two that illustrate it. One is, he used to say, tell a story about a certain event that happened in the Russian army, where the Tsar once came to visit a battalion that was to present a parade for the Tsar. But the Tsar was late. And so when the Tsar arrived late, the officers had all taken themselves off to the officers' mess, and they were dining on very expensive Russian caviar and vodka. They were having a wonderful breakfast, while the men stood in the sun on parade. When the Tsar arrived, he arrived before the officers had time to scramble out. And the Tsar faced all the men and he said, anybody know how to drill these men? So a young Jewish boy, it says, stepped forward. Young Jewish boy, drafted into Russian army, and he said he thought he could. So the Tsar asked him to proceed. So he ran the whole parade, wheeling, drilling, marching the whole battalion on parade. While this was going on, the officers all standing there, very, very, can you imagine, feeling terrible. Watching this whole parade. When the parade was over, the Tsar turned to the commanding officer and he said, tell me, how much do each of you cost me a day? So the officer said, 2 rubles a day. And he said, and how much does this boy cost me? He said, 2 kopecks. So the Tsar turned to the officer and he said, you aren't worth it. That's what the Chofetz Chaim says. That if you're here doing a job and you're costing Hashem, means you're taking out of the world, you're living expensively, and you're not sending home the goods, so then you're putting yourself in a situation of extreme danger. Because you may be called to account at any moment. And if you're called to account, you have to show that you haven't extracted more than you put in, but I haven't been doing your job otherwise. He used to say this. He used to tell a story about a man. It's a simple message, but again, we have to hear it, otherwise we don't know how to put this into effect. He used to tell a story about a man who was shipwrecked. The person has to know the story. Man is shipwrecked. And he was washed up on a desert island. And as he swam ashore from a raging sea, naked and dripping, and he climbs up on the beach of this island, he sees a whole reception committee come down the beach to meet him. Whole delegation of people are there to meet him. And they call him king. They start hailing him as their king. They put on him rich robes of a king. They take him to the palace and they put him on the throne and he starts ruling. So he doesn't say anything, this man. He doesn't think about it. He doesn't want to say anything about it. And he carries on. After a few months ruling this kingdom, he realizes that he better look into this. There's something very strange. This just isn't normal. And so he finds a trusted advisor who always gives him good advice. And he takes him into a secret room and he says to him, what's going on? I know this isn't natural. I'm not a fool. What's going on here? So the advisor says to him, good that you asked. So not everybody does. But the story here is as follows. That what happened to you, what is happening to you, happens every year over here. Every year a man gets washed up on the beach here. And we all go down and we greet him and we hail him as a king. And he rules the island for a year as a king. So the king says, and then what happens? So the man says, at the end of the year we take him off the throne. We walk him down to the beach, we take off all his clothes, we put him into a little wooden boat, and we push him out to sea. And we wait for the next one. So the king says, what should I do about that? So the man says, well, if I were you, I would start exporting. I would export. Well, when this year's over, you're going to have nothing. Start, I'm sure you're with me. Start sending abroad, whatever you can. Send your family abroad. Get married. Send your family abroad. Send everything you can export abroad. And that way, at the end of the year, when they send you off in your little boat, you row off to the mainland. And there you'll be. So the king did that. He spent the rest of the year exporting as much as he could from the island. And true enough, at the end of the year, they came to get him. They marched him down to the beach. They sadly took off all his clothes. They put him in a little wooden boat. And they pushed him out to sea. And he started rowing. And his heart was singing. Says the Chavetz Chaim, that's youth. That man's youth. You get born here, naked and wet. Washed up from a storm. People greet you and they start fussing all over you. They dress you. They look after you. They feed you. And you rule. You start to rule. But a person doesn't take the time somewhere along the line to ask what's going on over here. It's not natural what's happening. To ask a question. And you must find a trusted advisor. The Chabad Chaim says the Seichel. Who else are you going to ask? Who else are you going to ask? Your lower self. Other people are worse than you. Who are you going to ask? Take the Seichel. Go into a private room. You understand the story? A beautiful story. And ask the Seichel what's going on. And the Seichel will tell you. Start exporting. At the end of the year, they're going to push you off in a little wooden box. Alone. That's what happens. And if you've exported the kind of things you can export from here, so then your heart will be singing. And you export the kind of things you can send abroad. You can't send abroad physicality. That for sure doesn't go with you. But you can export what's exportable. Mitzvahs, ma'asim tovim. You can export your own personality, what you make of yourself and what you build in the world. And when that time comes, and you push out to that sea again, and then your heart will be singing. Let's finish with a brief look at the practical side of this. Okay, this is painful, but let's try together to see what it is practically that we should be doing to put this into effect. There's another side to this discussion which we just don't have time for this evening. And yet, Hashem, maybe next week, Blinder, next week, Hashem gives us the chance to be here together. We'll talk about the aspect of what it means to divorce oneself from physicality. But we'll try and discuss that because we don't have time now. But there's a tension in the world between getting involved in the physical world and divorcing oneself from the physical world. The non-Jewish concept of spirituality is to transcend physicality. Right? That's why people become monks and ascetics and they live without any. Our approach is to get involved in physicality and still be spiritual and transcendent. It's a great paradox, and that needs a whole discussion in its own right. And Emet Hashem, we'll try and discuss that subject next week. But let's just leave ourselves with a consciousness for now, this first of a two-part series, of how we can apply this practically. And the things that we should be conscious of are as follows. Very straightforward and very simple. One, have as little as possible. Make do with as little as possible. If you can do without acquiring a thing, don't acquire it. If you have already, you already have possessions, or you need possessions for certain reasons, such as a man who has a wife who has certain needs, it's a valid reason for a man to acquire those things. If she's correctly tuned and needs them, and she may need them for valid reasons, like fitting in on a societal level with her equals in society, a man is then obliged to provide those things that his wife needs. And if she requires him to dress or appear or have certain things that are fitting for her honor because of their station in society, then he also deserves and must have those things. But he has them for a spiritual reason, because of the honor of his wife and because of his own dignity, but not because he's attached to the physical things. We'll try and discuss that next week. But the first rule is to have the minimum. The second rule is to what a person does have, first and foremost, should never be exposed. It's too dangerous to expose even normal things, let alone things that are things that many others don't have. Especially around you, and even if in a more distantly people don't have. And therefore a person should be very careful to have the things that are beautiful should be beautiful on the inside. A person's home, for example, can be much more lavish inwardly than it is outwardly. A person should be very careful when a person needs to buy certain things. A vehicle, for example. A person should be very careful not to choose the most expensive. Certainly not the one that looks the most expensive. If a person needs it for a certain reason, should ask a shayla. And understand, sometimes a person does. He needs it for a business image, let's say. And to be successful, he needs that thing. And that could be a kosher application. It might well be. Some people are in professions or businesses where a person needs to appear successful. And that could be a valid mode of living in order to be successful, which a person may need to be for what he's supposed to be doing in the world. And if that's true, then it would be permitted. But even then, a person has to have the consciousness that he's only doing it for that reason and never becoming attached to it for its own sake. It's much too dangerous if he becomes attached to it for its own sake. Thirdly, a person should take what he has that is beautiful or expensive, or those things that others don't have, and he should dedicate them to the service of Hashem. At least 10% of them. At least the expense account should be not more than 9 times as much as the goods you're sending home. At least a miser for Hashem. When the Chofetz Chaim was trying to teach us that you should be living here on a budget, on a very, very narrow budget, and sending home good business, but at least not to make it more than 9 times, not 10 to 1, the other way. At least not that. That means even if the expense account is running to 9 times what it is that you're sending home, but at least send home 10%. That's halacha of ma'aseh, that a person should give 10% of what he earns, definitely to the stock, and it should be a valid stock. Certain causes, even Jewish causes, are not valid causes of stock. You must ask a shayla whether it's going to buy you the merit and the existence and the life in the next world and this world that you want. Not every Jewish cause is stock. A person should try and choose Torah as a place to give the 10%. People are learning Torah. Fund and support Torah institutions. You get the double merit of stock and you get the benefit of the Torah learning of those people who are learning. Even if you never learn yourself, you get 100% share of the people whom you support. And there are two opinions in it. One opinion is that even if you help somebody, and the other opinion is you must support that person. That means that he couldn't do it without you. Fortunately, not everyone holds that. So even if you just give to somebody that helps him to carry on his Torah learning, so you have the benefit of his Torah learning. Or to support Jews, there is also a certain mitzvah in giving to non-Jewish causes, but certainly the Jewish cause comes first, as does people who live in your town. You are obliged by halacha to give to Jews in Johannesburg before you give to Jews in other parts of the world, and those who are related to you before you give to those who are not related to you. The person has to study it. You have to know the halacha. If you find Jews who don't have enough to eat, and there are people, if you don't know such people, give it to me. I have a fund, personally, that I use to give to people. A lot of people give me a lot of money, which I give to people that you probably wouldn't know about, but they're people who budget for their meals. There are people even locally who budget for their meals, because they're in Torah learning. If you're interested in finding Jews who don't have enough to eat who are not in Torah learning, I can give you an address, somebody you can give the money to. I'll tell you where. Supports families that aren't religious at all necessarily. Got nothing to do with Torah, but are starving. We need the money. And not starving because the Jewish community supports them, but only because it supports them. Person should take everything that they have, not only their income, but the objects that they have that they use, especially if they're flashy, and try and dedicate them in some way that they use correctly. You don't want them to be taken away. If you put them to the right uses, so then you may merit to continue being able to use them in the right way. A person is not allowed to give away more than 20%. Not more than a fifth. It's forbidden, except for certain emergency situations. But otherwise, 10% you must give. And you're allowed to give up to 20, but not more than that. A person must know that. Finally, I would say that to generate any consciousness at all of how to handle this area, if you live here, it's probably impossible. The best you can ever get living here as a balanced consciousness about what it means to have and not to have and priorities in materialism, probably it's impossible living here. Take some of that material wealth, buy tickets, travel to Yerushalayim and go and live in Yerushalayim in the Torah community. Live for a few weeks, take off a month. If you're in a position where you can afford it, it's an obligation. Take a month or 6 weeks, whatever you care. Go learn in Asa Meach Yeshiva. Live in a community where you see people who budget for their meals. Live in a Torah community where you see professionals. People I've lived with for the last 10 years. People who have professional qualifications, who could be living in the lap of luxury, wherever they want it, who are agonizing over small things that they have to buy their children. I know families, many families, who are not aware of where the meals will come from on Shabbos. I have to live in a place like that. You have to see people who are my neighbors. I have neighbors in Yerushalayim from France. Talented young couple. They have 4 children in a bedroom. A small flat in Yerushalayim. The children don't even have their own beds. The children have 4 beds stacked. And at night they pull out their beds. There isn't enough room in the bedroom for them each to have their own bed. If a child wants to lie down during the day, a child has to pull out a bed. They have a bedroom. They're exceptional children. Exceptionally beautiful children. They're concerned only about generosity. The children glow. They literally glow. Once a great Rosh Yeshiva visited us, Leonora Men in his 90s. And he looked at Telstone where I live. It's a beautiful place in the Judean hills. Plenty of place for the children to play. Most of the people are poor. Most are poor. Most are giving everything that they have so they can sit and learn Torah. But there's place to play. There's room. Trees and grass. He looked out and he said he thinks that the children, amazing, amazing comment, a frightening comment. After telling us many, many times how he admires the people there and the beauty of the people who live there and the spirituality and the glow and the beauty of the children. And I know him very well, this man. I heard him say it many times. He once looked out at the children and he said to me, he thinks that the children who live in Mattersdorf are better than the children who live in Telstra. He thinks he can perceive there's a higher level to the children. So I said to him, why? He said he thinks it's because they're much more cramped over there. They don't have the room, they're squashed on top of each other, and they learn to get on with each other, and they develop the kindliness, they develop a kindliness, and a generosity and a concern for each other that's more intense than in a place where they can spread out. This person might be doing their children harm by giving too much. Certainly are doing harm by giving too much. My next neighbor in another building is a young man, a Yemenite young man, who lives in that apartment only because the person who owns it allows him to live there for a nominal amount. Because he learns in yeshiva, full time. He's also a talented young man. But he chooses to learn full time and his wife insists on it. And they can't afford the rent of the smallest apartment. What does he do with his spare time, this man? He runs a massive free loan fund. That's what he does. He loans hundreds and thousands of dollars. I myself have been the recipient of a loan from that free loan fund. To people who don't have enough money. That's what he does. He handles thousands and thousands of dollars. That's what he does. But himself can't afford the rent, let alone the dream of buying one day an apartment for himself and his family. The person has to live in such circumstances to feel what people are doing, what Torah learning means, what sacrifice means, what it means to live like that. And then a person can come back and they can live in this environment and they can live with the things that they have around them. They can sit on a leather lounge suite, whatever else it is that they need in their homes. But it'll never be the same again. I learned this, the first time I saw it was from a close friend of mine who became a Baal Teshuva in Australia. I was very struck by this young man. A very talented attorney whose father was the Governor General of Australia, who today is one of the leading legal theorists in the world. He's a professor at Oxford, honorary professor at Oxford, friend of the Queen's, by the name of Cowan. And my friend Joseph Cowan became Froom and left one of the top legal posts in Australia to live in Osamar. And Joseph Cowan has to budget for his meals. He lives in a small apartment in Ramot. And he and his wife budget for how they'll pay for the meals. Because he's learning Torah in Osamar Yeshiva. This young man told me that he grew up in a home with 21 bedrooms where there were 4 wine glasses at every meal. And he once told me that if there wasn't dessert, if there wouldn't have been dessert, he and his brothers would have broken the furniture. So if you want my humble opinion, a person must travel to a place like that, and a person must live in that kind of environment and absorb what those priorities are. It wouldn't be feasible to live that way here. Probably wouldn't be allowed halakhically. It's not necessary. But a person must have that consciousness to see what he has in proportion. It's not just nice, not just a philosophical idea, not just idealism. It's a life-saving idea, a life-saving means, right? A life-saving step that we need to get in touch with in this community. The session will carry on next week.